You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we probably don't want to fuck you because we have preferences, values, and standards. As always, thanks for stopping by, and if you enjoy your trip today, please, please tell a friend. Referrals are our number one source of tourism here in the Midside. Although, I do want to say thanks this week. We got Patreon donations from Kirk and Andrew Dalton. Now, I know it's probably not the quarterback for the Cincinnati Bengals, but I'm just going to pretend that Andy Dalton supports the Midside. And talking about supporting the Midside, I would like to tell a little story today to start. The story is about the Hail Snydra t-shirt and the apparent impossibility of printing it. I want to read you an email I sent to the site that printed the site, Teespring, because they have sent two rounds of t-shirts out now and misprinted both of them. So this is the email I sent to them. Teespring team, I am extremely disappointed with your product and customer service. I am the designer of the Hail Snydra campaign. Insert URL here. The purpose of this campaign was to create shirts to promote my podcast and celebrate Zack Snyder. The shirt is going to be sent to Zack Snyder himself. You know, the director of Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman. I know an actress who worked with him, so this isn't random delusional fan nonsense. It will be sent to him. That is, if it's ever printed correctly. But besides him, huge fans of my show bought the shirt. They deserve a high-quality product too because, you know, they're human beings who worked hard for their money and spend it on what they value. Recently, the second round, all caps, of shirts started arriving. All caps, it has the same error as the first round of shirts. Please see the attached picture for reference. I emailed you about this error the first time. Jarek replied and told me you'd look into it. I waited 2 days for a reply and didn't receive one. That means it took you more than 2 days to see there was a simple printing error. Shouldn't this issue be minor for a professional printing company? I emailed again and received a reply that you were working on it. I never heard from you via email again. I even sent two more emails that have never been acknowledged. Finally, I chatted with someone who apparently just ordered a reprint of the shirt. What? That makes no sense. I designed and ordered a product. People who value my show and work ordered a product. We deserve what we ordered. What is in the product? Fix this issue. P.S. Here's a suggestion. Before you print our orders again, print one sample of the shirt to make sure it prints properly. I'm sure someone who works for your company is awesome enough to want to support Zack Snyder and thus would appreciate the work perk of the free shirt. I then received a reply from them. This was their reply. Good morning, Justin. Thank you for emailing Teespring. I'm very sorry for any inconvenience in this matter. When the original issue occurred with the shirts received... This doesn't even make sense. When the original issue occurred with the shirts, received a photo was sent over to our production team. Wow, I didn't even realize how bad of grammar that was when I read it this morning. And on May 12th, I was informed to offer the reprints as the issue was corrected. I apologize if you still have issues with the items received. I will send this over to production again to review. However, you would, please give specifics on what you do not like about how it printed. Sincerely, Laura. I'm now guessing her name is not Laura, would just be my guess. And then
Laura Nahasapima Pentalon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's see. I replied. Thank you for your reply, but this is not about my not liking something or my feelings. There is an error in the print. Attached to this email, you will find a screenshot of the picture of the shirt on your site with a picture of an actual second version of the shirt next to it. Look at our show emblem. The word Midside is unreadable because the JML logo was printed in solid white. I'm perplexed as to how this issue isn't easy to identify and correct. And then she replied with a generic, I've reached out to our production team. I will email you as soon as I hear back from them. In the meantime, please let me know if you need anything, Laura. I need my fucking t-shirts printed correctly, Laura. That's what I fucking need. Need anything else. Yeah, while we're at it, could you, send me, like, all the money back that people spent? Like, what, anything else? Like, what else would I need from you? You're a fucking t-shirt production company. I need you to do the one thing you do correctly. Like, ugh. Joining me this trip via Skype from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. Daniel, this really reminds me of the Adam Carolla Amazon DVD story he always told around Christmas. Am I imagining that comparison?
No, I was going to say that maybe you need to cut back on your Carolla listening. Getting a little ranty with the world, aren't you?
Does this not deserve to be ranted on?
I'm just happy that I finally got my t-shirts. I received both today.
And they're both misprinted, right?
The original misprint and the new misprint.
It's the same thing. They literally just reprinted it. Like I said, like, I don't even understand it. Like, supposedly it was fixed? Like, did you not fucking look at, like, is there just a machine and you don't look at it before you fucking put it in the envelope? Like, I don't understand.
I don't know. I didn't know that t-shirt was this enormous shirt conglomerate where everything got caught in the gears of the bureaucracy. I thought it was maybe a little smaller of an operation. They might be able to, you know, look at a product and see that they made a mistake, but apparently I was wrong. Apparently a company the size of Teespring can't handle such a task.
Yeah, I mean, crazy. Not to make us look bad, but like, it's a run of seven shirts. Seven shirts.
Yeah. Well, partially probably why they don't give a crap. If it was 7,000 shirts, I think they probably would double check.
Well, they're going to give a crap now because now they've done two runs, so they've taken a loss on this, and they're going to do a third run and take a loss on it, and I will fucking complain if they misprint it again.
I suspect that fairly soon you'll have an entire wardrobe of Hail Snyder shirts that are all misprinted and one that is correctly printed.
That's kind of my goal at this point. I want to turn into Doug, where I wear the same thing every day.
And of course it would be a Hail Snyder shirt, so.
Also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. Elliot, you are the front line of this, so I'm surprised I haven't pissed you off yet because you keep sending the picture because you're so close to their distribution center in Kentucky that you get the misprint first, and I get so fucking pissed off when you send me the picture of the misprint.
Look, whether misprinted or not, I'm wearing that shirt to MegaCon, Harvard Comic-Con this Friday, Saturday, both days because I have two shirts. And I'm gonna wear them.
Oh, this is where I turn in Adam Kroll and it pisses me off. That's a major event and you're going to be there in that shirt and it's goddamn misprinted.
They'll be like, who made this shirt? Jay.
They'll be like, what does it say there? What does it say? And I'll tell them, that's the logo for our podcast. Welcome to the Midside. Boom. Marketing. What up?
Jay, indecipherable L.
Welcome to the...
This is a big company. I'm looking at Teespring. They have four offices, and they had a $56 million investment from Y Combinator, Koshla Ventures, something like that.
Look, I did it through this company because of price, but also because I had previously bought a t-shirt through this company through a campaign like this for a nerdcore artist, and it's a good t-shirt. I wear it a lot. It printed well. It washes well. And it was a complex design. So I don't know why they keep fucking us up. Maybe they're doing it on purpose. Maybe they hate Zack Snyder.
Secret conspiracy.
Or maybe they don't hate Zack Snyder. Because you know what we're going to do? We're going to talk about other things that people don't hate that they supposedly should hate. It's time for The News with Daniel T. Richards.
Just a fad. 'Cause kid, there's consequences to what we say and what we do. While you're dancing like an idiot, they're looking up to you.
Apparently, saying Redskins will be among the least offensive things we say on this show, at least if a new Washington Post poll is to be believed. In fact, 9 out of 10 Native Americans say they are not offended by the term Redskins or by the name Washington Redskins, the football team whose moniker has been controversial for quite some time now. The Washington Post reports that the survey of 504 people across every state and the district reveals that the minds of Native Americans have remained unchanged since a 2004 poll by the Annenberg Public Policy Center found the exact same result. Keep that in mind. Responses to the Post questions about the issue were broadly consistent regardless of age, income, education, political party, or proximity to reservations. Yes. Of course, the owner of the Washington Redskins, Dan Snyder, has been using this poll and basically just mounting it atop his middle finger as he goes down the, Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, to be fair, we have to let him celebrate because this is the only time he's going to win anything.
It's true. It's true. Even with that tight end, Jordan Reed. And who's their quarterback? Kirk Uncle or something?
Yeah, Kirk Cousins? Uncle, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They're not gonna do much.
Kissing Cousins.
Yes, indeed. There are many interesting things about this article, not the least of which is that Native American advocacy groups basically said, screw you, we still think it's offensive, and your poll is dumb. Every quote in this article about why this poll is bad is just people saying, I reject the findings of this poll.
That's my favorite thing about this entire story is, you know, it's not about the fact that, like, they're proven wrong. It's the fact that they're proven wrong, but they don't want to lose their legitimacy, that they have to just reject this. Like, you know, they're all sitting around, like, does it say the name of the groups? Isn't it, like, the National Native American Association or some shit like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know the acronyms. Like, you know, they're those word letter soup acronyms. But they're just like, you know, they're sitting around in their fucking, like, sweat lodge having a powwow, like, oh, we're obsolete. What are we going to do? And they just fucking deny. It's just, fucking get off the peyote. You're obsolete. You're done. You're over.
This wasn't just a standard poll either. The Washington Post took time to talk with people.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Can we pick another word besides poll? Because I'm feeling very triggered as a Polish person.
Oh God, that is, it's cause you're dumb.
Wait a second.
For instance, Barbara Bruce, a Chippewa teacher who lives on a North Dakota reservation, said, I'm proud of being Native American and of the Redskins. I'm not ashamed of that at all. I like the name.
Wait, how the fuck is her name Barbara Bruce?
It's called marriage.
Yeah.
Well, she's not Native American enough then to count in this poll, is she?
She lives on a reservation. Her main name is Barbara Bruce, but that's closer than you or I. So,
I'm going to steal Justin's point from him. Because I know he's going to make this point, but I think that this is really just proof of Michael Bay's 50 people on the internet. I mean, this is it just applied to a different situation, but it's the same principle. It's always the smallest group of people shouting the loudest, and then you realize, oh, it's not actually everybody in the world. It's just these small groups of people.
In this case, it's just the 50 people in the casino instead of the internet.
Yeah. In fact, someone made that point in the article, a New York resident, Judy Ann Joyner, a retired nurse whose grandmother was part Swanee and part Wyandot. I've never heard of that tribe. Wyandot.
I didn't know there was actually a Native American tribe named Swanee. That makes me really weirded out.
Oh, yeah. So she says, quote, it's 100 people okay with the situation and one person has a problem with it. And all of a sudden, everyone has to conform. You'll find people who don't like puppies and kittens and Santa Claus. It doesn't mean we're going to wipe them off the face of the earth.
Let's bring her in. I think she's an honorary midsider. That sounds like midside commentary right there.
It's an awesome
quote.
The crazy thing about this to me is not just that it's so overwhelming and consistent, because again, in 2004, there was a poll that found that exactly 9 out of 10 Native Americans didn't give a fuck. Turns out they still don't. But that it's across party lines. Usually you'll see something like this, but it's like, oh, they tend Republican or whatever. here are the numbers. 80% who identify as politically liberal said they didn't give a fuck. 85% of college graduates didn't give a fuck. 90% of those enrolled in a tribe didn't give a fuck. 90% of non-football fans didn't give a fuck. 91% of those between the ages of 18 and 39 did not give a flying fuck. Even 9 in 10 of those who have heard a great deal and are very familiar with the controversy say they are not bothered by the name. And what makes this more striking, asked the Washington Post? The general public appears to object more strongly to the name than Indians do. In fact, in a 2014 national ESPN poll, 23% of those reached called for Redskins to be retired because of its offensiveness to Native Americans, more than double the 9% of actual Native Americans who now say they are offended by it.
Well, there's a couple things here. First of all, this is like the Seminoles in Florida, remember? When people are like, they need to stop being the mascot for Florida State. And then they asked the actual Seminoles of Florida, and they were like, no, we like it. And one yes. of the guy who rides in on the horse is actually a Seminole, right? He runs in and he throws his spear at the grass because it needs to die.
Because we hate nature. He either has to be
fuck you, other team, I will kill this grass!
Or I think he has to train with them. Like, it's something like that. It's not just someone in a costume. Like, it's serious commitment.
Yeah.
This is another one of the non-controversies that the left uses simply to bash people, with the moniker of racism or sexism or whatever ism, in this case racism, that they can just use to control them.
Well, that's the second thing that's going on, is this is just white guilt, is what this is. This is white people who feel bad about being white, because they've been convinced that they have white privilege, so they have to find a way to make their penance on it. Oh, well, we'll take away the football team we named after you, because we feel bad about the fact that we have all the money, even though, joke's on you, white people, they take all your money when you go to casinos. So, I think they want to keep the name, they want the Raiders to move to Las Vegas, so you'll keep betting on the Redskins to win, and every time they lose, they fucking get your money.
It's true. And speaking of white people, apparently Snapchat thinks we're all white people. At least according to a latest controversy, non-controversy, please read. This is from Mashable, probably it's one step above Gawker for me. They've gone from a legit tech news site to social justice pieces of shit in about a year. So here we go. Snapchat has once again come under fire for how it deals with race. Users of the app have noticed that many of the face-altering filters whitewash. Upset Snapchatters point to the flower crown filter and the beautifying filter, both of which seem to lighten skin and eyes and contour the face to make one's chin and nose appear smaller. Since the debut and subsequent popularity of the Coachella-inspired filter, Snapchat users have taken to, guess where, Twitter and Tumblr, to voice their disapproval of the app. Mm-hmm. So, someone named Ain't No Wifey says that Snapchat needs to make a smoothing filter that isn't whitewashing like yesterday. At Simply Allegra says,
wait,
Snapchat,
so she's not only asking them to change the filter, but to also invent time travel?
Yeah.
That seems a little extreme.
Yeah, definitely wouldn't make her my wife. At Simply Allegra, Snapchat, I'm very disturbed by the fact that your beautification filters make my skin lighter and my nose and jaw smaller. Just saying. Mm-hmm. Does anyone notice that, like, when you take a selfie, the flash of the camera makes your skin lighter?
It's not even that. Like, when has it been decided that Snapchat is saying certain filters are make you more beautiful and certain filters don't? Because today they have all the X-Men filters. And I just posted a snap of me bamfing away as Nightcrawler. Like, would everyone say that makes you more beautiful if you look like Nightcrawler? Or more to the point, when they have their normal filters, like, half of the fucking normal, not even half, 75% of the normal filters, like, make you look fucking ridiculous. Do you think they made that dog filter that all these fucking girls use to make them look beautiful? Do you think they realized that that's what girls would use it for, to look cute? Or they were just like, hey, let's make this filter, and then people would use it. I think they're wrapping their own value judgments into Snapchat.
Of course they are.
Was just like, oh, people go to Coachella, so they would like a Coachella filter, and the people who don't go to Coachella and want to pretend they're at Coachella, which is like fucking two levels of being a poser, because like, if you're at Coachella, you're already a poser, and then you're posing that you're a poser, we can give them a filter for that. That's all it is. Nobody fucking said the people with that air filter. It's like when you see a girl with a dog filter, she's probably a fucking basic bitch, as they say. And, you know, if they got the Coachella filter, they're probably a basic bitch, too. Like, this is your fucking judgment. Get off Snapchat's nuts.
Drinking that hashtag PSL.
Mm-hmm.
I just love the idea that the people behind Snapchat, the idea of them sitting in a meeting and just going, you know what we could do? We could do a whitewashing filter that makes black people look white.
And yeah, that would fix race. Totally.
What they're talking about is, as we all know, since the advent of the internet, women have used cameras and angles to obscure the fact that they're fucking hideous in real life. And what this filter happens to do is make it look like you don't have a fucking pizza face because you pop all your zits. That's all it is. Or it makes you look like you don't have a pizza face because you have lots of zits and don't take care of yourself. So they call it whitewashing because it does that. And
if you're using the swap face filter with your African-American friend, are you there for black facing?
Chris D'Elia did that, the comedian, because he has a character using one of these ridiculous filters. He has a character that always talks about how awesome Donovan McNabb is. So when the face swapping thing happened where you can swap with a picture, he made the Donovan McNabb one.
And that wasn't racist? I don't know what's racist anymore, so I have to ask. There should be a website, isitracist.com, where you find out if the thing you're doing is or is not racist.
There you go. There's another $1 billion idea, right? We keep coming up with these startup ideas. There you go. Yeah. Somebody else out there who has more time.
Yeah, Katrina, don't you live in that place where they pump all the money into technology?
If you watch Silicon Valley, you know how to get funded now. So watch that show, know how to get funded, then know how to lose being CEO of your company, then learn how to get it back. So basically just learn contrived drama and then you can make $1 billion off of this.
I'd like to make you know, at least a couple billion. That way I can retire. I'm pretty done doing this podcast, so any amount of money helps. This is not the first time that Snapchat has been in trouble for, messing with people's skin tone. If you remember, on 420, they had a Bob Marley filter, which many users condemned as a blatant use of, quote, digital blackface. Snapchat, though, stood behind its filter saying it was only meant to give people a new way to share their appreciation for Bob Marley and his quote-unquote music.
I mean, aren't they right, though? I mean, it's not blackface, it's Bob Marley face, and he happens to be black. Like, they're looking at it collectively, and Snapchat's looking at it individualistically.
I guess I never understood the blackface controversy anyway. I mean, I understand that there was a time in America when white actors used to put on blackface and sort of do these imitations, and that is sort of clearly offensive. But in most cases, people are just putting it on in a non sort of criticizing way. Like in this instance, to celebrate Bob Marley, is that a bad thing?
Right.
Like, you're trying to celebrate this person?
They appropriated the term blackface to be a racist face, basically.
It's a nice racist face you got there.
Yeah, everything's
racist. Shame if anything happened to it.
Yeah, everything's racist now. It's a racist face.
Racist face. Well, speaking of everything being racist and horrible and terrible, Facebook, which if you remember from last week, hates conservatives, turns out doesn't hate conservatives. If you recall the story, Facebook was being accused of censoring, even though that's not the right word in this context, conservative news in their trending news feature. So in order to calm everyone's shit down, Facebook decided to have a beer summit at the Facebook headquarters with a bunch of conservative leaders, which apparently included Glenn Beck. And Glenn Beck wrote a interesting and viral article on medium.com/@Glenn Beck.
Which, by the way, you don't usually hear very often. Glenn Beck wrote an interesting and viral article.
Correct. And it's titled, What Disturbed Me About the Facebook Meeting? And so you expect, as you're reading this article, that you're going to get something about Facebook being disturbing and the meeting being weird. But he continually praises Facebook throughout the article, saying that Facebook is the most important media tool of his lifetime. And so let me get into this. And I might read a little bit at length here, so I'll try to be quick. In a country that is deeply divided, the largest and most important company in human interaction and content consumption saw the conservative movement in an uproar over one person making one accusation against one of their products. one story in the Pitchforks came out. Now, that's something we conservatives are accustomed to, but not so much for those on the left. Sure, the purpose of the meeting yesterday was to appease the angry voices, at least to some degree. They took the opportunity to explain to us the details of the products and how they really can't be consciously biased, although they did admit that unconscious bias can creep in. But to me, the purpose of the meeting from Facebook's point of view was to acknowledge that if one story and one accusation can bring out the Pitchforks, the more fundamental issue to address is a lack of trust. That's an interesting thing. And so he goes on to talk a lot about Silicon Valley and being liberal, but then it pays off here. So what disturbed me about the Facebook meeting? I sat through a meeting that, to me, felt like I was attending a Rainbow Coalition meeting, that people, not me, had come with a list of demands. I looked around the room, I heard the complaints, I listened to the perspectives, and not a single person in the room shared evidence of any wrongdoing. Maybe they had some, but it wasn't shared. And this is basically what he's pointing out is, what the hell, conservatives? Like, aren't we the ones who constantly talk about the fact that companies don't have to have quotas, they don't have to have different diversity ranks, they don't have to fucking cater to every whim of every person who wants their product to do something? But yet in this instance, when we feel like we're being wronged, we're not coming to Facebook's defense, we're trying to tear them down just like a social justice warrior would tear them down. He says, quote, it was like affirmative action from conservatives. When did conservatives start demanding quotas and diversity training and less people from Ivy League colleges? Isn't this kind of surprising from someone like Glenn Beck?
Well, yeah, I mean, this probably speaks to the way I read internet news nowadays, but I didn't read the byline. Well, you sent the article and I just started reading it and I was like, oh, that's a great article. We should use that in the podcast. And then I saw Glenn Beck wrote it and I was like, what the fuck?
Yes. He goes on, what happened to us? When did we become them? When did we become the people who damned the who demand the Oscars add black actors based on race? Someone made a good point at the meeting. The invitation alone from Facebook was staggering. Conservative voices are rarely, if ever, invited to the table for an open dialogue. And so his point being, this is not – this company, Facebook, is not our enemy. They're the ones trying to do right by us. And if they did fuck up, which there's very little evidence to suggest that they did, they're trying to make it right, so can we put the goddamn torches and pitchforks away? Which I think is excellent.
Well, this is revealing of an interesting psychology that's developed on the right. And it's sort of like a persecution complex has developed. It's they're so used to, you know, fighting against the lamestream media, as I think Rush Limbaugh calls it, and they're so used to, you know, the way Ann Coulter is, that it's, you know, this has resulted in this, you know, Trump, basically. It's the idea that we're the persecuted and we need to fight back so we won't be put on the trains and have numbers stitched into our arms. It's like, dude, do you remember when people were actually persecuted in the world? Like,
this is the Adam Carolla principle of we're out of problems.
You know, it's 100% that. It's yeah. I mean, I know my dad doesn't listen to this anyway, so I'm just going to say it. It's, you know, people like my dad who sit around and listen to Rush Limbaugh and watch Fox News all day, and then I call them on the phone and they rant about this stuff. It's like, don't you have other shit you want to do? Like, yeah, I get it, you're retired, but fucking, I could sit around and listen to stuff all day at work, but I have shit I want to do, and I have ideas I want to engage with myself, and I want to improve myself. I'm not out of fucking problems because I'm still alive. But no, the conservative movement has developed this idea that they're persecuted, and if they would stop being persecuted, if the left would stop persecuting them, they would be fine, and the world would be fine. And this is, as Glenn Beck's pointing out, is it's a weird way they've become sort of liberal in that way, where liberals are based upon being the victim, right? Be the victim so the government can take care of you. Well, now it's the same thing with conservatives. It's not be the victim so the government can take care of you. It's we are the victim because we don't want government to take care of us. So again, this is why we're seeing the Republican Party crumble and the right wing crumble, because they're not defining themselves. They're completely reactionary. And this is where they become.
They're letting the left dictate the terms of the discussion. A lot of this comes from the fact that, and I don't even think most of these people actually mean it when they try to do victimization. They're just so frustrated with the fact that the left appears to have done it so well that they want to recreate that. It's more like they want, like the left does it, why can't we do it? And when you try to explain to them, because we have to act on principle, we should not engage in every single thing that the left does, then all of a sudden, you want to vote for Hillary Clinton. You want Clinton to win. We need Trump and blah, blah, blah. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what this is really all about.
Absolutely. Well, there's more outrage on the internet this week. Yes, we have to round out the news with outrage. It is a week in outrage, in fact.
Isn't it always a week in outrage on the internet?
Yeah. Although the last story was kind of positive? Sort of. Anyway.
No, it was positive because someone in the mainstream, a major political thinker, a major cultural thinker, is starting to say what we've been saying and is starting to call it out. You know, I mean, to expand a little bit on it, this is, you know, be like Zack Snyder, be like Tom Brady. And what I mean by that is when we sit here and we defend Batman versus Superman, do we complain? I mean, I say I don't get it. I don't understand. But we say, you know, this is what we love. I mean, Elliot, I think it was the post on your page where I responded and I was just like, I don't understand why we have to keep comparing dick sizes. Like, I liked Batman versus Superman. I didn't like Civil War. You liked Civil War. You didn't like Batman versus Superman. You being whoever the person I was replying to. Why do we have to turn this into a dick measuring contest? And that's like what conservatives and liberals are doing right now. They're like just whipping out their dicks and measuring them on the internet. Just fucking believe in what you believe in. And as Elliot said, act principally upon that. Don't worry about comparing with the other side.
If only. So a picture has caused quite a bit of controversy. We're reading from a BBC story. This photograph of a father holding his son in the shower has been shared tens of thousands of times on Facebook in the last fortnight. That's how you can tell it's a BBC article. They use fortnight. But over the same period, it's also been taken down by the social media platform more than once before ultimately being reinstated each time. Why? So the picture is of a naked father and a naked son sitting in a shower. And so for many viewers, the image is a touching portrait of parental care and affection. The reason the father and the son were naked was because the son has salmonella poisoning and was releasing fluids. And the father was being very loving and patient and caring. And the mother, who is a photographer, thought this was such a touching sign that she wanted to share this through a photograph, through her artistic medium. Now, you can decide if her judgment about taking the photo was necessary, proper, what have you. But she's an artist, and this is how she wanted to express herself. And then when she put this on Facebook, she got all these horrible messages about why this picture should be taken down. It's sexualizing children. It was compared to a pedophile. And she was blown away. She wrote in her initial post, "There is nothing sexual or exploitative about this image. I was taken aback by how many people missed the story or didn't even look past the nudity to find the story." And then, of course, Facebook took it down, and then they put it back up, and then they took it down again, and people reported it as inappropriate. While the same kind of picture, an Australian woman posted a photograph of herself naked holding her daughter in the shower, and that is sort of universally loved and seen as a sign of affection and caring. And so I brought this up because it asks a very interesting question about males and their interaction with children, males and this sort of concept of over-sexualization, meaning men are constantly looking to have sex, even if it's with a child. And I want to get both of your take on this, because this is to such an epidemic proportion in our culture that I feel anxious if there are children in my general vicinity who are not mine, like in a public place. Like, I try not to look at them, interact with them, because I'm afraid that some mom is going to run up and accuse me of being a pedophile.
Look, Daniel, I'm with you 100% because I tutor. And I tutor ACT and SAT. And that means I tutor high school girls. And, okay, they're high school girls. And, you know, you can look at them and you can say, oh, well, that's, you know, a cute high school girl. But, like, when you're a man, like, you're not interested in that. But then when you can see, you know, the way they're acting and you're like, oh, I don't want that to be seen as inappropriate because I'm a guy and I'm the one who's going to get in trouble, even if she's the one who's doing things like that. So I'm with you 100% because to me, this comes down to this idea that male sexuality is seen as predatory. It's this idea that we want to fuck anything at any time because that's all we want to do is fuck. that we have no standards and values, that, you know, there are some people we don't get erections for. It's just, like, you know, that old myth of, like, guys just get erections randomly at any time in school and they just have to cover them up. Like, you know, that doesn't happen all the time. Like, I don't know, personally for me, like, I can't, like, it's just, I wouldn't be able to just fuck anything. Like, if you put a woman in front of me and was like, fuck it, I wouldn't be able to.
Who in your hypothetical is doing this?
No, I mean, that obviously would never happen, but my point is, it's the idea that, and this is actually something that I've been struggling with lately about, you know, approaching women and everything, is there's such this belief that guys want to have sex with any woman that it's sort of like, you know, women will reject most guys because they assume, oh, well, the guy's not interested in me. He's only interested in sex. So then as a guy, it almost becomes a compliance test. Is you just go around asking women out until one of them's you finally find one that's like, yeah, I'll have sex with you. So it's not who you really want to have sex with. It's just sort of who lets you. And that's the idea we have of male-female interaction.
All that's correct. I think there is this strange perception. I sort of want to morph this over into a different kind of cultural discussion, which is specifically I want to ask Elliot, do you have this kind of psychological stress? Now, especially around children, I used to think that I was unique, and then I started talking to other guys and like, oh no, hell no, I can't look at children, talk to children, because like I just live in permanent fear of being called a pedophile. So is this something you as a homosexual male deal with, or do you think this is a straight male problem?
No, I think in fact, I think a lot of gay men are probably much more aware. Just because, especially when I was growing up, you know, the myth of pedophiles being homosexual men and raping little boys, and the fear that has pervaded throughout the Boy Scouts and the Catholic Church, among other institutions and organizations. Growing up, I definitely think that I've heard more horror stories about men being pedophiles than I think most people have. So I think homosexual men, gay men like myself, I think we're even more aware, because I think in a lot of cases, and not all, and not to sound like a leftist, but I do think that in many cases, there are a lot of people who are already set against homosexuality. Even if it's not necessarily a moral disagreement, I think that they don't necessarily understand homosexuality as well as they could. So they categorize it along with pedophilia, among other things. And so they think that we're all part of one club or one big group. So for me, I definitely am much more aware about how I conduct myself around children, especially, you know, when you work at some place. I worked at Disney for such a long time. And with a name tag, it's amazing what you can get away with when you have a Disney name tag and you have the Disney brand covering you. But if you behave that same way, where you just giving a high five to a little boy wearing a Stormtrooper outfit, it's, you know, it's different when you're not in costume, when you don't have that brand protecting you. So I would say that I think gay men probably have it even worse than straight men, because I think gay men are sometimes lumped into that category, even by other straight men.
Well, let me follow up with you on that, Elliot. Isn't the gay male community known for being obsessed with youth?
You know, interestingly, yes. It's very obsessed with youth. And I think a lot of people take it to an extreme where, oh, they're watching the Barely Legal Boys, you know, where they're 18 and they're still children and all that stuff. But it's one of those things where it's not everybody. And even then, legally speaking, if a person's 18, they're an adult and they're making these movies. So the idea that every single gay person is a burgeoning pedophile, and some people do have that idea. It's something that for me, I'm very aware of.
Yeah. And of course, in this photo in particular, we're talking about a child. It's not even like a borderline thing. Like we're talking 17, 18, 19. It's a child. So this is clearly something where that doesn't even come into play. And I find it sad. Like it's one of those things that can, if I think about it for too long, can actually put me into a small depression. Because I think it's bad that children are missing out on interaction with adult men. Like,
yeah.
I don't know, even saying that, like even coming off of my tongue, that felt bizarre to me to even say that out loud. because I'm live in fear of someone listening to this and taking it out of context.
Well, this is the self-reinforcing cycle, the self-perpetuating cycle. Why do you think masculinity has been lost in this society? Why do you think men are shit on in this society? Because only a woman are allowed to raise children and teach children how to be. How do you teach a male how to be a man if you don't have a man talking to him? A woman doesn't know what it's like to be a man, just like a man doesn't know what it's like to be a woman. So women want to sit around and tell, you know, men, you know, don't tell us how to use our bodies and what to do with our bodies. You don't know what it's like to be a woman. Well, don't fucking tell your son the same thing. Get him a goddamn male role model and tell him it's okay. I think this picture, we want to talk about judging the art. I think this picture is beautiful. That father did something rational. He said, hey, you got all these fluids just leaving you, evacuating your body. I'm going to sit in the shower and I'm going to comfort you while this is happening. And the most logical way to do this is be in the shower so we're both clean as that's happening. Not only is he comforting his son, but he's cleaning him as well and taking care of him. That is the model of fatherhood to me. He's taking care of him physically, emotionally, and psychologically. And we're demonizing this picture and reporting it as a bad thing. This is the ideal we should hold up. This isn't the negative. This isn't the evil in the world. This is the ideal.
Amen, Brother Justin.
It's funny. This ties into the previous story, the story about like what Glenn Beck wrote, because in a way, they both touch on the same thing, which is how people regard the world. We've discussed a lot about benevolence on this show. And I think that this shows the damage that comes about when you have a lot of people, even if it's not a lot of people, but people who just choose to regard the world as a malevolent place where everybody's out to get you. Everybody is a criminal. Everybody is a potential pedophile, potential rapist. I mean, it is in the same thing. I mean, as in the previous story that Glenn Beck was addressing, it's all about how we have chosen to regard the world that we live in. The filter through which we have come to view it. And I'm not talking about like a primacy of consciousness type of way, but if you...
But it is though, Elliot. It is primacy of consciousness.
No, it's not. But if you choose to regard the world as a place that is complete, that's always going to be at your throat, that's going to be detrimental to you, then just the life that is possible to you, you'll never reach its potential. It can't.
All right, so James, if you're out there listening, I'm going to do a little philosophical detection here, so you can ombudsman me next week or whatever. What the fuck? What's the verb, Dan? Ombuds?
Ombud.
Yeah, whatever the fuck the word is. You can do that next week. I think this is an example of primacy of consciousness. So if we use the principle that other people's reaction to you or to art is more about them than it is the art, well, people who are looking at the art and saying this is evil are exactly what you're saying, Elliot. Everything you just said is 100% correct about their psychology. Yeah. But why do we give credence to it? Why do we say it's true? Why don't we say, well, there's something wrong with you. You need to look into that. We don't give we do give credence to it. We don't critique them because of subjectivism. Subjectivism is true. So everyone's truth is true, which ultimately is primacy of consciousness. So it is primacy of consciousness. We say whatever somebody's reaction to that is true. That is their truth. We don't ever check and say, can your feelings be wrong? Because you know what? You're feeling it, experience it, but your feelings can be wrong. If somebody treats you like shit, you shouldn't feel bad. You should feel good, right? Oh, that shitty person treated me like shit. That means that, oh shit, they obviously don't think I'm good. Do you want a bad person to treat you good? No. So your feelings can be wrong, but we don't say that anymore because of subjectivism, which ultimately is primacy of consciousness. Did I do a good job, James?
I guess we'll have to wait for next episode to find out.
Dun, dun, dun.
So to clarify, I'm not saying that they're not operating on primacy of consciousness. I was making the point that when I say how a person regards the world, I was saying that I do not mean in a primacy of consciousness way.
Oh, okay.
You know, just clarifying that. I'm not advocating primacy of consciousness. Just to be clear.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. All right, folks. I've had enough outrage. Let's get on to... Oh, wait, fuck. There's more outrage coming.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the Ghostbusters trailer, Daniel. That's going to cause more outrage.
Yeah.
Let's move on to that and talk about some new stuff this week in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. I want to start with a couple of reviews, and I want to do the first one really quickly, and then we'll move into the second one, which I want to spend a little bit more time on because I think it's more deserving. The first thing I want to review is Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising. This is the sequel to the surprise hit comedy Neighbors, which made over $100 million. Now, the first one was pretty good. I really liked it. It was very funny, starring Seth Rogen, Rose Byrne, Dave Franco, of course, and then Zac Efron. Those were the main stars of that. And it was about neighbors warring with their the people next door, the fraternity living next door. The second one takes that same premise, moves it forward a few years. It's starring Chloe Grace Moretz, who is known as Hit Girl, and she is trying to start an alternative sorority because apparently there's a rule that sororities can't party, which is why they always have to party at fraternities. Is that a real rule, Daniel? Have you heard of that before?
Never heard that rule. Did not apply at my college, and definitely did not apply at Clemson.
Okay. So they have this rule that exists, and the movie tries to make statements about gender and everything because of it. And it's really, they have to balance all these character arcs and everything, and the moments of humor are few and far between. It's ambitious, but it doesn't execute like the first one did. So I would give it about a 6 out of 10 is what I would give it.
God, you're so generous.
Well, I mean, look, it's still Zac Efron, Dave Franco, Seth Rogen, Rose Byrne. They're still funny, and the production value is good, so there's some good things in it. I mean, I would say I enjoyed it about as much as I enjoyed Captain America Civil War. Horror, outrage.
Whip out that D.
Yeah. But there is something that I enjoyed immensely that I want to talk about.
I watched this, by the way.
Did you do what I did?
I can't possibly know the answer to that question.
Well, that's the tease. We're setting it up. So what I want to talk about is Maria Bamford's new comedy on Netflix, Lady Dynamite. Now, we've been critical on here, or I've been critical on here, saying Netflix does not have very many good series. Now, what happened was this show came out and it started getting hyped. So I watched the first episode, and then I was like, oh, we're going to review the pilot on the podcast, and I put that in the outline. But then today, I had to remove the word pilot because this show was so good that I ended up watching the entire series over the weekend, the entire first season of 12 episodes.
I think I'm through 6 of them, so I didn't watch the whole thing. It didn't quite compel me that much, but yeah, I'll save my review. But
yeah, well, first of all, that's how starved I think we are for good content. So we often talk about how there's like over 400 scripted series or some number like that, some ridiculous number like that. But how many of them are actually good? Not that many. Whereas finally, yeah, exactly. Especially comedies. Now, if a good comedy finally comes along, and I guess I was starved for it because I was just like, want to watch more of this. So the basic premise is it's about Maria Bamford, and it's sort of showing her mental instability because she has bipolar disorder 2 and OCD. And it's using the show and the show's format to literally show it, to show what it's like to live in that. But what's interesting to me about this show is how it actually demonstrates that even though she's crazy, everyone else isn't that far off from how crazy she is. And in a way, it was perfect that Mitchell Hurwitz, the guy who did Arrested Development, which is a show about crazy people, did this show. It was like the perfect marriage of performer, material, and producer. The show works on 4 levels, I would say. The highest level is it works on a meta level, where this is a commentary on Hollywood and television and comedies. Where there's meta jokes. For instance, in the first episode, Patton Oswalt breaks character and pulls Maria Bamford aside and was like, you're not going to do stand-up on your show, are you? Because that's what every comedian does, like Louis C.K. And then it also, the other 3 levels it works on is it does past, Duluth, and present. And what this does is it tracks Maria Bamford's life through these different periods. The present is where she's trying to get her career restarted. And the past is when she was in Hollywood before. And Duluth is when she's trying to deal with the mental breakdown that she had. So she had a mental breakdown and she had to be committed and go through therapy and everything. And it shows how she dealt with her family and all of that. And the reason I tremendously enjoyed this show, or enjoyed this show tremendously, don't make fun of my syntax, is I thought it portrayed what was going on with her perfectly. I understood it. I understood her mental state. I did not get frustrated with her. I did not get upset with her. I empathized with her. And it was also very funny. And at times, I thought she was the less crazy one. So, based upon everything I just described, as well as the quirkiness and the originality of this show, I would give it an 8.5 out of 10. I tremendously enjoyed the first season, and the payoff at the end is wonderful, and the last scene made me feel so joyful and joyous.
Yeah. Weird. Not where I thought the series was going, but that's interesting to think about. Yeah, I had heard a lot about this, and it was getting some buzz around the intertubes. So I decided to watch the the pilot, and I basically just sat there the entire time with like one eyebrow cocked and like my mouth a little bit open, sort of just going like, what the fuck is going on right now? Which I think you're supposed to. I think that's an appropriate reaction. It's not, certainly not outside of...
Yeah, the pilot is the most jarring of all the episodes.
Yes, it slowly gets normaler.
What, you mean as she gets as she gets healthier, it gets normaler?
Yes, yes.
Not intentional, is it?
So, yeah. There are a couple things to really like about this. One, it's original. It's certainly original, because I can't imagine this ripping off anything. It's so bizarre at points. Two, the writing is a mixture of humors. So there's super clever humor, there's sort of absurdist humor, and then there's like fart joke humor.
Yeah.
And so it's eclectic in that regard, which I think, again, is supposed to be part of the mania element of it.
And that was something I wanted to ask you about, and why I really wanted you to see this show. In the writing, did you see the Arrested Development style humor?
Yes, unequivocally. Not only because there's some of this, it's a mixture of those types of humors, but also like they'll talk about something and then they'll cut to a picture of what they're talking about for like three frames and then cut back with like goofy music underneath it, which is very Arrested Development.
And the ridiculous names they give of things, and how witty the names are, but how also spot on they are satirically.
Yes, and how everything is a running joke in every scene. So yes, like every single office building has office of so-and-so on it. Like the Judd Apatow office is a giant tower with the words in like 75-feet letters, office of Judd Apatow.
Oh, then speaking of, I'm gonna ruin the Judd Apatow joke though, but like the way they were like, the perfect Arrested Development moment when she's on the phone with Judd Apatow and he's like, he's talking about how he's gonna do his spinoff of Bridesmaids and Ghostbusters, the new one. Which, yes, first of all, that's an Arrested Development thing, but then Maria Bamford replies to him and she says, oh, did you name it Bridebusters? And he's like, no, that's really good, but we were gonna call it Ghostmaids. And then I don't know if you've seen it in a later episode, they actually show the logo for Ghostmaids.
Oh, I haven't seen that far yet, but
the
yeah,
fact,
a
like,
lot of
all
it
of
is
that is
humor.
Very Arrested Development to me.
Yeah, Mitch Hurwitz certainly put his stink on the show in a good way. And then the third way that I think it's really fun show is that the characters are really, what is the word? They're not like nuanced and subtle. The characters have this bizarre over-the-topness about them. Every single fucking character you meet has their own flavor. And I actually really like that about comedies, where like you can get into like the character. Like her agent is this sort of like huckster kind of, doesn't really know what he's doing, just sort of falls into things. He's bizarre. And then the agent who is courting her is this ridiculously insane, over-the-top, Hollywood-loving, complete stereotype of an agent who is fucking amazing. Like, there's no other way to explain it. And just all of the characters have this bizarre characterization that I think is worth a watch. So
well,
I would give this a... a solid 8.
I outdid
world.
You again?
Yeah. Always. I'm always going to be harsher. Always.
To me, that's why comedy is so well suited to romanticism if done properly. Because you can have the characters embody these different ideals and ideas.
I'm not claiming this is necessarily romantic, but it's not naturalistic.
No, I definitely, I think it's romantic.
It's almost like surreal.
Yeah, well, it's on that line that Hannibal was on, right? Romantic surrealism. I mean, Hannibal.
Like surrealistic,
yeah. But I will say this about the pilot. The three characters I hated the most in the pilot have smaller roles as the series goes on. And the two best friends are I find to be very grating, and they wisely backgrounded them after the pilot. And then I also did not like Anna Gasteyer's character that much, and they found a way to use her better as the show went on.
The third episode, by the way, if you're only going to watch one episode of the show, if you decide maybe the pilot's too weird for you,
I agree.
Watch the third episode, which is about how Hollywood tackles race issues. It's fucking perfect.
Yeah.
There has never been a more perfect satire of Hollywood and race.
Well, and that's part of why this works, is it's not just a satire of Hollywood. It's, you know, Maria Bamford, she comes across as she's supposed to be the crazy one, but really what's making her crazy is this fucking politically correct, second-handed society we live in. I mean, so much of what she deals with is being a people pleaser. And when she isn't a people pleaser is when she's healthier.
Yes, absolutely.
Also, so. Dean Cain. That'll make you crazy.
Dean Cain. Completely almost fell out of my chair when he came on the screen. Couldn't believe he was in this show.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, you should watch it. It's cool.
Yeah.
It's fun.
All right, let's take down some trailers.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
So the trailer first take one, down.
Trailer take down. Yeah, somebody out there make some, like, music or something for us for that. So the first one we want to talk about is the new Ghostbusters trailer. And what I specifically want to talk about is we don't have to talk about the trailer itself. We can talk about this controversy around it. And the question I have is, why is there a controversy? It seems like people are trying to make this a sexist thing, but is it because the movie is actually just looking bad? Because it looks bad to me.
Elliot, what do you think? Sexism or terrible?
I think it's a nostalgia thing. Honestly, I think that people, they just don't, they're tired of Hollywood constantly going back to the movies that we all grew up with in our childhood and regurgitating them and bastardizing them and aborting them like fetuses and making them worse.
Yeah, that's true. It's definitely a nostalgia thing, and there's been some reaction to that. It's hard. So, like, when you take on franchises like Ghostbusters or Star Wars, there is so much history that you have to be really careful about how you do that if you don't want to alienate your audience. I'm not necessarily saying that there is some inherent thing that you couldn't redo Star Wars in a different way, or you couldn't redo Ghostbusters in a different way, but if you're going to do that, you need to be sure to fucking nail it. You have to. Otherwise, you're going to alienate people who love that brand. And I think that's what they're doing with this.
I agree, but they're trying to paint it as, like, this sexist thing. Like, if we don't like the movie, it's because we're sexist. But to me, I watch these trailers, and there's nothing compelling about them to me. I just don't want to watch the movie. And like you said, I hold the original Ghostbusters in high esteem. So to me, it's kind of like taking a dump on that legacy.
Yeah.
It's just that it's blatantly an attempt to appease the social justice warriors. That's all it is. Whether the movie is good or not, that's not what it's about. They're not doing this to tell the story. They're doing this just to appease people of a certain political ideology. That's what it comes down to.
And you don't want to second guess, you know, the artists here, because I haven't seen the movie yet, but it seems like there's a way in which they could have incorporated the mythos of Ghostbusters into a new generation in the same way that Star Wars did, right? In Star Wars, you have the old characters almost, I mean, in some cases, like literally handing over the lightsaber to the new generation, right? And then back again at the end, I guess that was a bad metaphor. But my point is that it's sort of like a reboot, but with the old characters, you're bringing in the nostalgia and then sort of passing it off to a new generation.
But come on, let's be serious.
Seems like you could do that.
If Melissa McCarthy killed Bill Murray, wouldn't we all be very angry at that?
Is she going to eat him? Or That's very bad. That's very bad of me to say. That's sexist. That's fat shaming. That's not very nice.
Good fat shame.
I shouldn't judge. Who's to judge?
But did you guys remember anything about this trailer?
I remember that it was bad.
But the first time I saw the trailer.
We're talking about the new one. This is the new trailer, right?
No, I have not really. I didn't want to.
Well, that sums it up.
But I remember the first one. They said like 15 or 20, whatever it was, years ago. 4 scientists defended New York, and now new generation. I thought that this was a continuation. So it's not a continuation at all.
No, and that's one of the things that was Melissa McCarthy talked about. That was one of the controversies about this trailer. Was apparently other people were confused about that as well.
I mean, none of the old characters are in it, right?
Well, Egon's dead.
No Bill Murray. I mean,
unless they're keeping it an incredible secret, like not on IMDb or anything. Like, so I don't know. It doesn't look like a good story. It just doesn't resonate.
It looks very shallow to me. It looks like a shallow movie.
Yeah.
There was a lot going on beneath the surface of the first Ghostbusters.
I mean, right. In fact, I mean, it gets argued over, for instance, whether or not it's like the perfect libertarian movie of all time or, you know, like there's a lot going on in the movie that allow people to conjecture about those kinds of things. But this movie just looked vapid.
Agreed. So I want to talk about another trailer now that I don't remember anything from.
Okay, go ahead.
Another trailer of a rebooted film series. They released the second Star Trek Beyond trailer. As I just said, I don't remember anything from this trailer. Do you guys?
Yeah, I don't know what the overarching dilemma is here, other than aliens attack Kirk and crew.
I remember now. It's vaguely Avatar-esque, isn't it?
Vaguely, yes. There's some people who look Avatar-y. So the first trailer to this movie looked like a shitty action movie. This trailer at least looks like a Star Trek movie to me. Now, it looks like a millennialized action-y Star Trek movie. But it looks like a Star Trek movie. The first one, fucking bikes jumping over fucking motocross. Like, what are we doing? Let's be serious here. This actually compelled me that I was eager. I'm eager to see this movie. I'm not sure it's going to be a good movie, but it energized me enough that I plan on spending money to see it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I liked it. I mean, I'm not crazy about it, but I mean, I'm going to go see it.
Out of everything, you shit on every trailer, Daniel. This is one you don't shit on.
No, I thought it was, especially in context of the first trailer, which was one of the shittiest trailers ever made for any movie.
And you too, Elliot. You're going to see, you guys, oh man.
I have liked the reboot of Star Trek thus far. Into Darkness wasn't as good as it could have been.
It's because it's Star Trek as Star Wars. That's why you like it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a better version of Star Trek.
They were terrible movies. They were good movies. They just weren't, you know, they weren't as good as they could have been.
I enjoyed the first one.
Into Darkness is pretty terrible.
I thought it's a stellar movie, the first one. Into Darkness is not as good as it could have been, and they really didn't use Khan the way he should have been used, but.
All right, one more trailer, and this one's for Elliot because it's Disney.
Yes!
Okay, there we go. I guess that's the reaction. Disney released the teaser trailer for the live-action Beauty and the Beast starring Emma Watson. Elliot?
Yeah, I'm so excited for this. Ah, I mean, I think it's beautiful. I think you don't see enough, like, of the story. They didn't show the Beast. But, I mean, I just love it. I think Beauty and the Beast is probably, like, my second favorite Disney movie of all time. Second only to Hunchback, of course. And I'm really looking forward to seeing this. I think it's going to be extraordinary.
But can Emma Watson play Belle? Isn't Belle supposed to be French?
No, I think Emma Watson can play anything she damn well pleases.
It's coming from a gay guy. Jeez.
Wow.
She's talented. I mean, she's just an extraordinarily talented actress.
Mm-hmm, well, that's not what I noticed in the later Harry Potter movies, but all right. I mainly noticed her ass, but... And my other follow-up question is, when are they going to do the live-action Aladdin? Or will they not, because that's racist?
Yeah,
they need to. That and Hunchback, those are the two that they need to hurry up and do.
Dude, if they do a live-action Jasmine, you guys will never hear from me ever again. I will just be jerking off perpetually for the rest of my life.
You'll just be texting send, lube, and Kleenex.
Yeah. I just need to get a feeder tube installed in me.
Oh, my God.
Stay hydrated. So post-Jungle Book, I am buying whatever Disney is selling. They did such a tremendous job with the live-action Jungle Book in a way that far surpassed any of my wildest expectations for a live-action Disney movie that I'm in. I don't care if I'm the only straight dude sitting in the theater watching this. I'm in.
Well, you just raised an interesting point. This might be, like, the best movie to get laid at.
What?
There's a lot of single, lonely women watching this movie.
Oh, fuck Martha. Off.
Single, lonely children, but yes. Yeah, I guess you could. There's that. And Elliot. And me. But I'm in. They did such a good job. And you will never see live-action Aladdin. It would be totally racist, and this couldn't happen.
Who would you cast as Jasmine, anyway?
Good question.
It should have been a Reddit question.
Yeah. There was a girl, the girl in Alphas, the Persian girl in Alphas. She might be good.
How about the Slumdog Millionaire chick?
Yeah, maybe.
Probably racist, but...
We're just naming people from there.
What about the girl who plays Hawk Girl on Legends of Tomorrow?
Kendra?
Yeah.
Yeah, she could, but people might complain that she's black.
She sings beautifully, though.
The girl on the League, Shiva.
Oh yeah.
So many cover
characters. If she can sing, yeah. Or if we're talking about singing, what about Selena Gomez?
No.
She can act. She can sing. She's in the Disney universe.
Yeah.
Possibility.
Okay. Harder question. Who would you cast as live action Genie?
Yeah, it sucks because he's dead.
I know.
That might be why they haven't done it yet.
I think they haven't done it because they did the Broadway musical, and that's the one where they're not going to be called racist. So they're just like, that's where we'll put Aladdin. We'll put it over there.
I mean, do you have to cast, like, Frank Caliendo to do Robin Williams? Like, is that what you have to do in this case?
I think they would cast a black guy as Genie, honestly. That's what they did on Broadway, didn't they?
I don't know. I haven't actually been to Broadway ever.
They did a Hunchback Hunchback and Notre Dame on Broadway and off-Broadway. And it's an amazing, amazing soundtrack. If they ever do a live action film, I hope it's of the musical, of the Broadway musical with the music that they have in there.
All right, moving on.
Yeah, let's hit up some news here.
Enough ganging up the midside.
So we've been critical of female comedians, female actresses, like, which is redundant, but with Ghostbusters. We've also been very praiseworthy of Maria Bamford, a female comedian. So anyone who thinks women can't be funny, watch Lady Dynamite. Next, I want to toss this question to Daniel because it's about House of Cards. Because I have my answer for this, but I want to see what Daniel says. Robin Wright, who plays Kevin Spacey's wife on the show, has apparently demanded equal pay for House of Cards. Does she deserve it, Daniel?
I don't think after the latest season that anyone deserves to be paid for House of Cards, especially the writers. So if that equal pay is zero, then yes, she deserves it. The show has become shit. Look, in terms of is her character important to the plot in an equal way that Kevin Spacey's character is important to the plot? Yes, in the later seasons, because they wrote it so that she can be whiny and everyone has to pay attention to her, otherwise she'll ruin her husband's entire life.
Sounds like Skyler in Breaking Bad.
And do I think that is the direction the show should have gone? Fuck no. You had such a better direction laid out in the British version or in the books that I just think it's become a completely whiny soap opera bitch fest. That, again, that equal pay should be nothing because they might as well just cancel it if this is the direction they're going to continue to go.
But she is the co-lead now.
She is now the co-lead, yes, okay. Because they wrote it that way. So,
only reason Kevin Spacey could possibly get more than her is marketability. That's it.
Yes. He's definitely more of the marketable character.
How many Oscars has Kevin Spacey won? How many has Robin Wright won? I'm sure it's like 20 to like zero.
Yeah, but you don't pay for, I mean, that's the Belichick principle, right? You don't pay for past performance. So you're not paying Kevin Spacey for his Oscars. You're paying him for performing in the role.
Yeah, but how many Emmys has he won in this role? How many has she won?
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot.
But
you know, the Maria Bamford show, I hope Maria Bamford is making more money because she is the show.
Yeah, she should give her all the money. Give Maria Bamford all the money.
So it's just, I mean, like, it's not a sexist thing. It's a who is the most important person to the show and the role and et cetera. But again, House of Cards moved themselves in a direction where she is the co-lead and to everyone going, "Bleh, no one cares." So congrats, House of Cards. You've social justiced yourself into being irrelevant.
All right, more Mitchell Hurwitz news. Apparently, he came out and said that season 5 definitely will happen, and also, apparently...
Season 5 of?
Of Arrested Development. Season 5 of Lady Dynamite. They've already greenlit it for like 8 more seasons. Season 5 of Arrested Development. And apparently, there's also another cut of season 4 that is cut more like a traditional sitcom. I don't know where that can be found, but that's what he said as well. So... that's the two questions I have for you again, Daniel, as this is another show you love. And Elliot, I don't know, did you watch Arrested Development?
I did not.
Okay, so this is definitely a Daniel question.
What are you doing with your life?
One, are you excited for season 5, or should it die? And two, do you think a sitcom-style cut of season 4 will improve it?
A new cut could only improve season 4. The worst thing about season 4 was not the writing, but the editing. I thought the writing was pretty good for season 4, but the way it was edited was so jarring, and they let scenes linger, and there was weird cutting because they had to shoot around all these people's schedules and I think they had to make it in this deadline, of course, that given a much longer time, a new cut is, God, it would almost be required if you were going to put it anywhere else. In terms of season 5, I was sort of satiated by seeing season 4, and it was sort of like, as opposed to like the cold turkey cancellation of Arrested Development, this sort of was our methadone drip to let us off the show. So I sort of got my fix.
Method 1 drip?
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Good self-referential humor there. I could sort of leave or take another season as long as they were trying to go back to what it felt like, what the original show felt like. Season 4 felt like a different show completely with the weird editing and stuff. So apparently everyone wants to do it, which is weird, right?
I don't think it's weird they want to do it. It's sort of like when you play on a team that there's such camaraderie, you want to keep playing with them. It's sort of like, I think they just, it's magic when they get together. Or it was magic, and I think it's something they all enjoyed. So I think that's why they want to do it. Does that mean they should? I don't really want to see it. I was done after season 3. I thought the season 3 finale was perfect for the theme of the show. So I'm sort of disappointed that it keeps continuing.
It was, and Elliot, by the way, I cannot oversell Arrested Development enough. It is one of the greatest comedies of all time.
I'd agree with that.
I'll take your word for it.
Watch that in Lady Dynamite. Stop making more Arrested Development. Make more Lady Dynamite. I don't know why I'm upset about this. The show just came out. All right. So other news I want to talk about. Let's move on to movie news here. And what I want to discuss briefly is DC and Warner Brothers. To me, they are on a PR mission. And what I mean by that is I feel like they're playing a shell game with the media. And it's not really working. So recently it came out that Geoff Johns has been named like the showrunner or whatever you want to call it of the DC universe. It says here, co-chief of DC superhero movies. But nobody in the media seems to be buying it because they seem to have such an attack on these people. I want to read a quote from the Vulture article about this. So it says, one phrase came out of his, Geoff Johns, mouth over and over again as he talked about DC Comics, hope and optimism. Though Jones would never speak ill of Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice or its director Zack Snyder, Johns is nothing if not loyal to the company that made him a star. It's crystal clear that his vision for DC looks a lot brighter than the much-aligned grimness Snyder provided earlier this year.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
Well, that's what I'm saying, that I think this is all PR. Like, they haven't really removed anyone. They haven't added anyone. They've kind of changed people's titles around. You know, they've made Ben Affleck a producer. They've given him a movie, which everyone thought he was going to be given. Geoff Johns was already working with them. This other guy that they've have working with Johns now was already working in it. It just, this is all very intriguing to me because I think it's all a PR thing that they're trying to combat the negative PR they've been getting over Batman versus Superman.
So they're trying to make it look like they did something to fix it when in reality they don't actually want to do much to, because there, nothing was broken? Is that what your argument is?
Yes, that's 100% my argument, that they don't think anything's broken, so they're just trying to change the public perception to maximize profits.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? The inner workings of these companies are fucking more of a mystery than the female sex organs. So, who knows? Like, it's just, they're just gonna do whatever they think is right to make more money. That's it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Last story I want to touch on, and this is a little bit more theoretical about sort of naturalism versus romanticism and storytelling and the role of death in storytelling. And I included this article because Elliot mentioned something to me recently and I wanted to bring this up. And this also, you know, it's about, this article is about Game of Thrones. And, you know, we also see this in The Walking Dead. George R. R. Martin came out and he said, Game of Thrones characters die because it has to be done. And to me, the phrasing has to be done is interesting because this is sort of a trope that has happened on television now, is main characters having to die. We see it often on The Walking Dead. We see it often on Game of Thrones. And, you know, as Elliot pointed out to me recently, it happens on Arrow. It happens on Flash. It happens on Legends of Tomorrow. I don't know if it happened on Supergirl or not because I didn't watch that show. But my instinct is death can, quote unquote, have to be done because it would work thematically with a story. But I sense that people are more doing this because, I don't know, I don't want to say naturalism. Maybe there's a sort of angst in our culture. Why do you think we're obsessed with killing off main characters in television shows now?
I don't know. Elliot, you want to take a stab at that?
Because people, it's an excuse to create drama, like, you know, in a cheap way.
So you think it's basically a way to avoid the responsibility of having to write real drama?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are instances like Justin and I discussed Arrow, how Laurel, the character of the Black Canary, she was the last person, really, other than her, Oliver's sister, Thea, who is a tie to his old life before the island. And by killing her, it serves the theme because it addresses that Oliver, his tie to who he was before, that he's completely severed. So he's now at a point where he has to truly decide, am I going to stay the primitive man on the island, or am I going to step forward and become the man of civilization, the man in the light.
Is this show Lost?
No. Better.
Sounds like Lost.
Okay. Yeah, it's very influenced by Lost, and that was one of the places I was going to go with the death thing.
But the point is that at least there, it can be done well, and it can be done right if you do it sparingly. But I think, unfortunately, it's just becoming too common. Something happened on Game of Thrones last night. I don't watch Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I don't spoil it. I'm two episodes behind.
Okay, well, I won't spoil it, but apparently something happened.
Well, that's good to hear that something actually happened on Game of Thrones.
I don't know. I don't watch that show. Maybe nothing happens.
So, Daniel, this is, I mean, you mentioned Lost, and what I was thinking about with Lost is, when they kill off Boone in season one, that was such a game changer for the show and for television in general. And then the show, you know, had shocking deaths from that point on. And that seems to have changed the way people tell television stories, where now main characters can be killed, whereas before, they never could be killed. Is it just because of Lost, or is it reflective of us being obsessed? Like, I can understand what Elliot's saying, that it's an easy narrative out, but why are audiences so willing to accept it? Is there something else going on besides Lost changing the playing field?
You think audiences in general are more sophisticated than writers? I don't think there's any evidence that supports that claim. Audiences are what made Keeping Up with the Kardashians popular.
So you're saying they enjoy the contrived drama from it, and that's why they're obsessed with it?
Yeah.
I think it's very easy to trick people's brains into, oh, this is important, or this is dramatic. For fuck's sake, we can do it with Pawn Stars, or Get That Gator, or whatever other fucking show we're watching on the Discovery Channel nowadays. I think that is the easiest explanation. I mean, the other thing going on is maybe there is this sort of postmodern obsession with death in cinema, and it might be even the sort of related, which is that death is seen as profound. So not just that it's contrived drama, but that if someone is dead, that is a profound moment in a show.
So I think The Walking Dead and Game of Thrones have that.
Yes, it makes them feel sophisticated or enlightened or something.
Yes. Okay, well, I think those are good answers. So are you guys ready to move on here?
Please, God.
All right. Let's hit up some Reddit on Reddit. Sony, stupid, Xbox, lame, PC, gaming all the way, EA, blow, Steam, rocks, got rest for my Firefox. See, these things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, whoring felines. Things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't host it, but we will repost it. First Reddit. Now this Reddit follows up with our theme of the episode that we were talking about male sexuality. And this is a post on the 2X chromosomes subreddit. And it's called, I finally realized how abusive my ex was. Now in this video, in this post, they link to a video. And the video is about a guy continually talking to his girlfriend over and over again about why she wasn't responding to his texts or calls. And he would, you know, keep getting mad and keep yelling at her and being like, I don't understand. Where she would say things like, my phone was dead or I was with my friends. And the point was, he was abusive and that wasn't really a loving relationship because he kept getting mad at her about that. And this girl on Reddit watched that and realized her ex actually was abusive. Now, this is my question for you. I understand that there's emotional abuse, and I understand, you know, there's psychological abuse and not just physical. But is that actually abusive, or is this, again, the demonization of males? Because to me, why is it okay for her to ignore him and never give him a straight or mature explanation, but him getting upset about it is suddenly abusive? Now, I'm not saying that's probably the best way to react to it. I mean, at a certain point, he should just be like, well, if you're not going to fucking communicate with me like an adult, then we shouldn't be together. But why is she treated, given immunity, where, you know, her behavior is fine, and he just has to accept it. And if he gets mad, he's the one who's being abusive.
Well, your point is well taken, but in the particular piece, I think it's very clear that his questioning is inappropriate or excessive or I don't know if I'm not sure I would go as far as abusive, but it's certainly detrimental to her being, whether or not it's quote unquote abusive.
But isn't her behavior also detrimental to him? Does she ever give him a valid reason why she won't respond to him?
Well, the piece is, it's not naturalistic in that sense, because what she's saying in the piece over and over again is like, I've already explained that to you. I've already told you the reason. I'm not going to explain it again.
Well, then I'm going to critique the art of the piece, because if you want the audience to accept that, you need to show her at some point giving a valid explanation for the audience to accept that she has given one. You can't just accept the character's word for it. You have to show it.
Well, yeah, you can critique the art of that, but look, I think the point that you can take away from the video, whether you're a man or a woman, and there are things to critique about the gender relationships in it, is that if someone, like, if you can't have sort of normal, non-fighting communications with your significant other, you need to significantly either change the way that you communicate or evaluate whether or not that's a relationship you can be in. Because you can't constantly have arguments, especially the point of this love labyrinth is the name of the film, is that they're in this cycle of constantly having the same argument. You can't constantly be having the same argument. That's detrimental for you. That's detrimental as to any relationship. So, you know, the way they portray it, the man and woman relationship might be a negative thing, but overall I think the message they're trying to get out is a good one, even though they do it in a perhaps a terrible way.
Yeah, I don't disagree with what you're saying about, you know, it could be either way that the genders are flipped in here, right? The genders could, yes, be either way, and I would agree with the message. I just think the word abuse is thrown around too much when we're talking about men. We don't talk about the way women mistreat men in relationships and the way women are abusive towards men.
And towards each other.
Well, I was talking romantically, but yes.
So am I. Statistically, you, a woman is, no, this is the truth.
From the gay perspective, come on.
Listen, a woman is statistically more likely to experience domestic abuse in a same-sex lesbian relationship than in a heterosexual one.
And what?
Wow. Yeah. Elliot dropping knowledge. Jesus, that's a good one.
But, you know, and even outside of that context, of a romantic context, women are terrible to each other. We discussed this before, haven't we? Women are terrible to each other.
Pretty much hate each other, yes.
I mean, that is the movie Mean Girls.
And it is real life, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So women, look in the mirror, all right? Jesus. Or maybe don't, according to this next Reddit. People who regularly take photos of themselves or selfies tend to overestimate their attractiveness and likability to a greater extent and are seen as more narcissistic by independent observer. And this Reddit links to an article that supposedly did a study on this. This is r/science, the subreddit Science. What do you think of this,
science,
Daniel?
It must be true.
Yeah, if it's science, it must be true.
Oh, shit.
I don't know. I mean, who am I to contradict a study without another study? I mean, I think it's an interesting finding. I don't think it's entirely unintuitive. People who take pictures of themselves think they're attractive. The question, and this is the hard part that a study can't really evaluate, is what if they are in the top 10% or top 50%, let's say? What if they are, on average, more attractive than other people? And, like, there is objective recognition of that.
Well, are you arguing you can't be narcissistic at that point, or are you, what are you arguing?
No, you can be narcissistic, but the article states, like, they perceive themselves as more attractive than the average person.
Oh, okay. So you're saying, well, what if
they're right?
Yeah, what if Tom Brady were narcissistic, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, if Tom Brady's taking selfies all the time and it's like, yeah, I perceive myself as more attractive than the average person, it's like, yeah, I'd fucking do him. He's way more attractive than the average person. Okay?
And to be fair, a lot of the narcissistic behavior you see on, say, Instagram are women who tend to be of above average looks.
I think people who are attractive get pretty big signals in their life that they're attractive. And yes, thus it triggers other behavior.
Yes. Well, especially attractive women, right? I mean, this is, again, Adam Carolla reference. This is one of my favorite things he does when he's taking a telephone call from a girl who won't give answers.
She doesn't listen and she won't give the correct, like, he keeps asking her a really simple question and she keeps giving this complex nonsense.
Or she'll give, like, one word answers because she doesn't answer. Yeah, mm-hmm. He'll just stop her and he'll go, sweetie, are you hot? And now hot girl syndrome has become a vernacular that I have. I've even had students that I've seen and they don't respond to me. Like female students where I'm just like teaching them things and I ask them questions and they give me 1 to 2 word answers or they're not really engaging with what I'm saying. And I'm not saying I find them particularly attractive, but I can see why they would have gotten that message.
Yeah. And
this is completely hot girl syndrome, where they haven't been asked to use their brains, so they don't.
Elliot, is there hot guy syndrome?
I don't think they call it that, but yeah, I'm sure there's quite a few. Those are the guys that, you know, they're very, especially among gay men, very, gosh, I'm trying to find a polite way to put it. They're very appreciative of their own looks, you know, very, to an almost elaborate extent.
Well, Tina Fey did an episode about this in 30 Rock with Jon Hamm, right? The bubble. How yeah. She dated him, but he lived in the bubble, so they couldn't be together. It was the bubble of being attractive.
I have never watched 30 Rock. That sounds funny, at least.
Yeah, they have some decent stuff. I've seen episodes here and there. But let's hit the last Reddit. And this is an interesting question, which I think, for me, has a simple answer. What should a person do in their 20s to avoid regrets in their 30s and 40s? By the way, fucking use a singular pronoun when you're talking about a person, all right? But that's another thing.
I have been thinking hard about this question because I think there are many sort of, I don't want to say stereotypical, but sort of typical answers you can give people, like, you know, eat better, exercise, good, fucking visit Europe or some other country that I don't care about. Europe's not a country, but really my answer to this question is more like try to find a purpose. That's not even the exact way I'm thinking about it. Basically, what I'm trying to say without being eloquent about it is try to live a life where you're going to minimize regrets in general, where you don't think of your life in terms of regret. Cause ultimately, no matter what you choose, so like if you, like I didn't pursue a lot of romantic relationships in my younger years. I more worked on my career and other areas of my mental health, but I don't necessarily regret that. I have a better way of thinking about what I was going to say. Be purposeful and conscious about your decisions, no matter what they are. There. That's what I wanted to say. So that you don't look back and say, I didn't consider doing this thing. That you think about your choices and you make them consciously. There we go. I knew that'd come to me eventually.
Yeah, I have a similar answer. But I'm going to say
it differently. I like going first.
Yeah. So my answer is do whatever the fuck you want. That's how you don't regret what you do. But here's the caveat. You have to do everything you can in your power to make sure what you want is what you really want and is not a result of any sort of psychological damage or trauma you've been through. So, like, I could say a lot of what I did in my 20s was what I wanted, but I can also acknowledge now that a lot of what I wanted was to, I don't want to say run and hide, but it was a lot of avoidance of what I really wanted but couldn't face because of issues I had. So do whatever the fuck you want, but make sure it's what you actually want to do. Which takes a lot of honesty. And you have to take a good, hard look at yourself. Elliot, what should a person do in their 20s to avoid regrets in their 30s and 40s?
I think the lesson that I probably would have appreciated in my 20s, and I don't have a lot of regrets now being, you know, in my early 30s, but I think that people who, especially nowadays, if you're in your 20s right now, you might have a tendency to kind of approach the world because of the current climate and the current culture. You know, you kind of have this idea of the world being kind of a malicious place, like I said before. You know, the idea that people are out to get you, people are out to tear you down because it's the only way that they can survive or that they can succeed. And I would encourage anybody in their 20s to regard the world with a little bit more benevolence. Understand that the world has a lot of value in it that, you know, and sometimes you have to, and most of the time, actually almost all the time, you have to seek it out. And don't be afraid to do so with a light heart, you know, and just have a resolve of steel, but have a heart that's light, you know, and don't let the people who are the kinds of people who tear you down, don't let them drag you down. Because those people, they're not going to matter anyway. They, you know, they just, And it doesn't have, what they do has no bearing on the entirety of the world and all of the individuals that comprise the world. So don't let yourself harden. Don't become a cynic to the point where you become a paranoid person. Regard the world with a certain measure of benevolence and goodwill, and you will be amazed at how often, you know, you are going to be proven right by taking that view.
So what you might say, Elliot, is that people should have a gay old time.
Yes, actually, I do. You should have a gay old time.
Again, yeah, due time.
Yeah, I was going to say, going back to the Flintstones.
Yes.
All right. What did we learn this trip? Daniel?
Well, I'm going to fucking steal it. I learned that women in same-sex lesbian relationships are more likely to experience abuse than those in heterosexual relationships.
That was
Elliot,
my answer.
With truth bombs.
My answer.
Yep, yeah. He stole it.
That's why I stole it.
Elliot?
I learned that apparently Ghostbusters is, you know, just sucks and that there's really no point in going to see it.
Justin, what did you learn?
Not to keep putting myself last on this outline for giving the answer of what did we learn this trip.
Yep. Haha, host. Well, if you learned something, if you experienced a truth bomb, if the truth was like a daisy cutter through your bunker into your soul and exploded all over your insides, why don't you tell us about it? You can go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. That's not 1 or 4 or 3 or 2 stars, but 5. Leave us a little note there. Check out the other notes from the past 5-star reviews. They're pretty fucking awesome. I have to say, we have some of the best writers of any audience ever. And then also check us out at twitter.com/themidside or facebook.com/themidside or themidside.com/podcast. And then of course, patreon.com/themidside. Holy cow. Patreon.com fucking exploded. We're flush with cash, as John Ralphio would say in Parks and Recreation. We don't know what to do with it except thank you and put it into the show and make it better and advertise and, I don't know, buy a bitches.
I'm just going to go to Vegas. I don't know about putting this into the show.
Straight to Vegas. Put
make
it all
your money
on black. So thank you for our Patreon supporters. You too can be a Patreon supporter by going to patreon.com/themidside. You can choose to give us a few bucks for every episode that we create.
And just to be clear, because sometimes I feel guilty, it is per episode. It's not like per month.
Right, right. It's per episode. And I think Patreon makes that pretty clear. It's a way that content creators can pay for bandwidth and lights. So many lights. We like to keep the lights on, as James was fond of mocking me from last week. So,
and I want to be clear, because of your support and because we're getting such great response through Patreon, we're working on some ideas to enhance the Midside experience. So
we are.
Keep that support coming because it inspires me to think about how I can create a better product for all of you out there. See
absolutely
how the market works?
Market responds, bitches. And of course, liberty.me, folks. Man, what would we do without our libertarian listeners? Fuck. Thanks, Gary Johnson 2016, unless you hate him, and then I also hate him, because I'm pandering. So, thanks, folks. See you soon.
I'm Justin M. Wisniewski, and I hope you learned something this trip. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
Good timing. Good timing, kitty cat. Quick pause, not only because there is a train going by. This could be the first time I've ever heard a train go by my apartment. I'm sort of wondering where I am right now. But two, I think your mic is still too hot, Justin. You're like peeking when, at the loud points.
Hold on. Let me go back into Skype here.
Off of this Hello? Idea.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Elliot.
Hi, hello? What's up?
Hi. Oh my
god. Are you guys still there?
Oh god.
Apparently we lost Elliot.
I'm gonna pause the recording.